And good afternoon, Tri-States, and welcome to this edition of your radio magazine, Voices of the Tri-States. Today, we are talking federal issues. Live on the phone with me, I have Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. And, Senator, good afternoon. Thanks for joining me here today.
Glad to be with you once again. How are you doing out there?
I am doing real well, Senator. In fact, just got back from a little bit of a vacation. I was in northern Minnesota. They were talking about their sweet corn wasn't going to be in until another couple of weeks, but I know at least around the Dubuque land area, ours is already coming in. And I don't know about your farm back home, whether your sweet corn is coming in that area yet or not.
Yes, it is. You can go to the shopping centers in Waterloo and Cedar Falls, and the trucks are out there, the pickups are out there, so you can buy corn coming in. And it's a good thing to have that. And it may be a little bit later. I don't know for sure. I think we'd normally expect to have it around the 4th of July.
That's what I was thinking, and I was really surprised when I was in northern Minnesota. They were talking about theirs. Of course, they were up near the Canadian border at least another couple of weeks yet, and I thought, well, we did have that really cold spring, and theirs was probably even colder than ours down here. So, well, Senator, I'm going to jump into questions right away here. Always hot on the federal issue on some things here. That Malaysian, let's start out with that, the flight that has now been shot down. First of all, our response from the United States, so what should our response be? Should there be a United States response?
Well, I think that we're going to have to, if Reich on their own, now that they're almost an international problem as well as just a problem for Ukraine at this point, I think if they don't respond to stepping in to push Ukraine separatists into talks with the Ukrainian government and show absolutely that they're stopping their military support to the separatists, then we're going to have to start giving more than just military meals to help the Ukrainians militarily. We're going to have to give materiel. Now, of course, we don't have the capability, and we don't want to put any Americans in any military action in that part of the world, because we're tied down now pretty well where we're already situated. But I think that that what I just said about military materiel and other supports, if Russia doesn't do that, and if Russia doesn't do that, then additional sanctions have to be put in place in addition to what was announced by the president last Thursday in his telephone conversation with Putin. And I would hope that now with so many Europeans, mostly 2/3 of the people dying from the Netherlands, as an example, that this would push Europe to impose greater sanctions than what they have so far. It's kind of disgusting that with the threat that Russia is to NATO and the instability that Russia brings to Ukraine, that the European Union is so lethargic about making decisions to put additional sanctions on Russia.
Are they that dependent on foreign oil from Russia, or what seems to be the, I don't know what the sticking point with them would be, because you're right, Senator, in the sense that this is a horrific situation, and why wouldn't they want to react in a very severe manner?
I'd call it economics or business or trade. For instance, the United States is only receives and only involved with about 4% of Russians' exports and imports. It's a far higher percentage in the case of Europe, and I don't have an exact percentage in mind, but far, far greater. And you've got a lot of interaction between business people in Europe with Russia. You even got a former chancellor of Germany being employed by the Russian oil company, as an example. And meet socially with Putin, as an example of the close ties that they have that we don't have, and whatever we have, we're willing to put on the line. China, or I mean Europe, ought to be the same position. And China, or I mean Europe, should be willing to do it now, especially because so many Europeans lost their life when a Russian missile took down that plane. Even though maybe the Russians didn't fire it, it wouldn't have been available to the separatists without the Russians giving it to them, and obviously the expertise to fire it, because this isn't something that any farmer from Ukraine can go put on a military uniform and be in a position to fire a sophisticated missile that brought down this plane.
Ultimately, Putin, is this something he's kind of testing the world to see what the response might be on something like this?
No, he's being himself.
Okay.
You go back to his KGB background, being a colonel in the KGB, the Secret Service of and Secret Police of Russia. He's made statements in recent years about the breakup of the Soviet Union being the biggest geopolitical debacle of the last century. He's given speeches as recently as 2005 that he wanted to put the Soviet Union back together. He'll never get it back together the way it is, but he is enjoying a great deal of popularity, bringing back the old time of the Soviet Union. He seems to have good standing with the American people. The trouble in Ukraine or his taking over Crimea is just small examples of what he's trying to do, and he'll never get it all done, but he's going to be a thorn in the side of NATO and the United States until we make it clear that you've gone so far and you aren't going to go any further. But he has visualized on so many different occasions, or he visualized that Barack Obama is a weak president, and he's taken advantage of it.
Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about our VA situation. We have a new secretary nominee, Robert McDonald. You've met with him. Let's just talk about, how did that meeting go?
It went very well, assuming he wasn't pandering and assuming he's serious about it. The main point I brought up, and you would expect me to do this, is my own investigations. Where do I get the information for that lead me to most of my investigations? From whistleblowers. Then you recently read about whistleblowers not being respected and being challenged within the VA system. So my point to him was that he needs to exploit all the information he can from whistleblowers, encourage whistleblowing, encourage them to come forward. It's such a big organization he has. There's no way, as even secretary in the president's cabinet for VA, that he can know where everything wrong is, rely upon other people to give him information of wrongdoing and mis-expenditures of money. He answered to me this way, coming from the corporate world of Procter & Gamble, as he does. He said, you know, we always had 800 numbers. We want to know what our customers were telling us and what our employees were telling us. And he also went to great lengths to tell me how, since he's left the CEO position of Procter & Gamble, he has even given instruction at seminars for military people, in other words, uniformed people, about benefiting from whistleblowing and knowing what's wrong. Now, if he carries that into the VA, he changes the culture of the VA, I think a lot of things can be changed just from information that whistleblowers can bring to him.
Overall, Senator, the VA situation, are you satisfied with the direction of where we're heading on trying to fix the problems? We've got the secretary or nominee here. Other things, hopefully, that are in place. Are you happy with where we're headed with this, or we still need to do a whole lot more?
Oh, a whole lot more needs to be done. On the other words, in another hand, I'm satisfied that when so much wrong about the VA has come out that I'm very hopeful that dramatic changes can be made. But one of these changes I discussed with the new secretary, the culture of the VA that discourages whistleblowing is what needs to be changed. I'm also hopeful that we will get legislation passed this week or next week that will reform the VA. But that's, no, I shouldn't use the word reform, because these are, this bill I'm talking about is just a very baby step of what needs to be done, maybe in the way of reforming the VA from the standpoint of passing legislation. Now, that point will not be decided for several months down the road. And maybe some of it can be administrative, and maybe this new secretary can do some of it administratively. But what needs to be done through legislation, we won't have that put together until, you know, a long time in the future.
Senator, when this first broke, and I guess as it goes on with the problems that the VA has experienced, does it make you a little bit nervous as we think about our health care reform and how that's all going to shake out?
Well, this is what I think you can learn from the VA debacle. It's 100% government run. And anybody that thinks anything that's 100% government run is going to be run okay, you've got the VA as a perfect example that isn't sound thinking. Now, you apply a big step forward through Obamacare to the government being more greatly involved in health care operations and decision-making and management. Then you probably got the VA as a pretty good example of what's going to happen down the road with a more government-dominated program in health care called Obamacare.
Senator, again, I'm going to switch gears on you here. Talking about our undocumented immigrants crossing the U.S. border, specifically our latest round of the youth, the spending, where are we at right now on what the president is calling for to spend on these issues for these illegal immigrants?
The president's calling for two things, $3.7 billion, and some change in the 2008 law so that they can be their removal can be expedited. The House of Representatives probably will appropriate something less than 3.7, and maybe a lot less, and may not even do that till September. From my perspective, a lot less, not saying that $3.7 billion might not need to be done what the president says and what he wants, but we could appropriate a billion today, a billion tomorrow, a billion the next day in tranches and just see how far it goes and make sure it's used to the extent we want to and make sure that the administration's doing all they can when the laws change to remove people.
And I guess
but I think the point is the two have to be tied together.
And that's the whole situation that I think the American people probably don't have any problem with, you know, helping a situation out, but knowing is the point is okay, so what happens in the future? Are we going to spend another billion next month and another billion the following month? I mean, what it just doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of seriousness going on with we've got to stop this. You know, you can't just try to keep putting Band-Aids on the problem.
Well, let's see if the president takes a strong enough view when he meets with the presidents of Guatemala, Honduras. I guess El Salvador is the third country he's meeting with on Wednesday. Hopefully that will be an opportunity to make clear that you should be doing everything in those three countries to keep people from coming here. Now, it's just not like people pack up and decide to go. You know, people call coyotes. People connect with the cartels, go around and recruit people and say, we can get these people into the United States if you give us $5,000 or $6,000. Somebody told me last night it might be down to $2,000 or $3,000. But the point is, people are in a very poor country, are getting people to cough up money that's probably used by the underworld without any certainty that they can deliver at the other end. And also, while in transit and even getting in the United States, the lives of the young people are in jeopardy.
And again, folks, I want to remind our audience here on the phone with Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. If you do have a question for the senator, you can give us a call here at 690-1370. Senator, I want to talk now big oil versus biofuels. Some fights on that going on again?
Well, the big international oil companies have been loudly suggesting to the EPA that they should reduce the amount of ethanol that's required to be mixed with gasoline, because big oil, international oil companies don't like to sell products that they don't control, and they don't control ethanol. So we have, back in November, EPA suggesting that they were going to reduce the amount of ethanol that was required. Now they got into a buzzsaw with a lot of us in Congress. They've slowed that up. They could have issued their new ruling January 28th. They've now waited for how long, and they haven't said when they're going to do it. The wait might be a partial victory for us, but it still breeds uncertainty. Cutting down on the investment, a capital investment in ethanol and biodiesel. So nobody knows where they're going to go with this. And if they would rule anything less than the $14.4 billion now required under law, then that would do harm to ethanol. And I think that that where we're most recently involved here is similar to where we were a year ago when Congress and Klobuchar and I wrote a letter to the Federal Trade Commission try to get them to investigate whether big international oil companies putting pressure on the retailers not to put in E15 and E85 pumps was anti-competitive. We got a letter that FTC was going to investigate it. I don't think, quite frankly, they've done much investigating. So recently, we've got a report, a study done by the Renewable Fuels Association that basically says that there is pressure from these international oil companies on their retailers, and that it's anti-competitive, and that's the reason we're not using as much ethanol as we should, and that's probably part of the reason the price of corn has dropped very dramatically. So Senator Klobuchar and I last week sent this study to the FTC asking for their consideration of it as a follow-on to our initial request. Whether they'll what they'll find or whether they'll really seriously investigate it, I don't know, but that's where we are.
Okay. Also, earlier, Senator, we had talked about the whistleblowing situation at the VA. Want to talk about whistleblowers at the FBI? I guess of all places, I would have never thought that we would have needed whistleblowers at the FBI. But there's apparently been some retaliation used against those who are doing some whistleblowing there. Is that right?
Oh, over a long period of time. I don't know when I first exposed problems with whistleblowing, but I would guess in the mid-1990s. The most famous case would be Dr. Whitehurst that exposed unscientific analysis of crime evidence. And he was more or less professionally hurt. He eventually resigned. He did get a $1 million settlement, I think, by threatening legal action. It led to a new $40 million crime lab. Hopefully things are better. But now we've had evidence coming out that the crime labs still have not been notifying people that are probably in prison. In one case, somebody maybe even already executed, where maybe the defense attorneys weren't notified adequately about some some things that came out of the crime lab that maybe were not scientifically just. And we have those instances. And then more recently, I can't get into the details of it, but we've had some other whistleblowers come forth just within the last week to talk about wrongdoing within the FBI.
And from what I understand, too, Senator, we had a task force that was to have worked and apparently had, you mentioned going back to the mid-1990s up until, I guess it was 2005, to look at the lab work. And from what I understand, this task force really hasn't done a lot. Is that right?
That's right.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's really got to irritate the bejeebies out of you, if I can use a term that's not really too bad on the radio. But, you know, to have something like this, we've got a task force that's supposed to look at this, and then nothing is done.
It's a violation of duty, violation of promise to Congress, not carrying out Congress's intent, and not being, I guess the president's responsibility to see that the laws are faithfully executed.
My goodness. Well, let's talk about something else. Veterinary Medicine Mobility Act. This was something that, again, I think was out in the last week or two. And I didn't even realize this was going on, but something where veterinarians, apparently there were certain drugs that they couldn't take into the field, say in farms and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a perfect example of the Food and Drug Administration. And I don't think it's the USDA. I just think it's Food and Drug Administration, not understanding agriculture and how veterinarians work and how animal agriculture is doctored. If you carried out the rule the way they wanted it, you'd have to load up your animals and take them to the veterinarian instead of the veterinarian coming out to your farm fully equipped to take care of any need your animals might have. So we raised Cain with the FDA, and we got an exemption for veterinarians that have their pickup trucks with these fancy boxes on them where they go out to the farm and can use these latest drugs that would otherwise been restricted to where their brick and mortar was, where their actual laboratory was, where their animal hospital was, whatever you want to call it.
It seems like you say just a total misunderstanding of what we do out here. I mean, it's one thing to take, you know, fluffy chihuahua that weighs 5 pounds to the veterinarian, but it's another thing to take your cow and have to take that all the way to town.
Yeah. Do you know this bill was recently passed, and it's on the president's desk, and he's expected to sign it.
Okay. It makes a whole lot of sense, but I think it probably was something that veterinarians probably had not even thought about and had been doing for years, and then, like you say, somebody who didn't even think about it had a ruling on there. So I want to talk about, there was another bill, the cell phone unlocking bill, restoring ability of consumers to more easily transfer their cell phones to other wireless carriers. What does this bill, is this something that, I guess it sounds like something that's going to be really good for the consumer out there?
It passed the Senate last week towards the tail end by what we call passing bills by consensus. There was absolutely no opposition to it. It was a Leahy-Grassley bill. It was for consumer protection. It allowed people that were otherwise locked into long-term contracts, once the contracts ended, they would be able to change carriers if they wanted to. There were some other protections in it as well.
And I guess, you know, because we are such a mobile society, too, something like this, I guess, again, like I say, consumer protection's always a good thing to have something like that as well. One last question.
Bill, the House has to take that bill up yet, but I don't think it's got any trouble in the House. I wouldn't think so.
Okay. One last question here, Senator, and I don't recall. I think the House has passed the transportation bill or some kind of an extension. Do you know where that sits with the Senate?
Yeah, it's a 10-month extension. It would be it would have $10 billion of revenue where it's paid for in it, and it's in the Senate this week, and we'll be taking that up tomorrow, maybe yet tonight, but we'll probably be on it all week.
Okay. Well, Senator, as always, I appreciate your time with us, and hopefully we will be hearing from you again next month.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All righty. Thank you, Senator.